that music. Have you seen the movie Jaws? Tell you what, it gives me a little shiver when I think about it. And I think it's part of a kind of a mindset that most of us have developed over the years, casting the great white shark in the role of unthinking killing machines. And I think that thought preceded the movie Jaws. It's been really going on for hundreds of years at least. And our next guest today has some different points of view about great whites and some of the other carnivores that exist with us here in this world. Gay Bradshaw is the founder and executive director of the Carolos Center. She holds a doctoral degree in ecology and also one in psychology and a master's in geophysics. Gay has established the field of trans-species psychology when she discovered PTSD in wild elephants. She wrote the book Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity, about that experience. Her latest book is titled Carnivore Minds, Who These Fearsome Animals Really Are. And we'll talk about some of the species he talks about and take your calls as well. Maybe you've had an experience with a carnivore that changed your perspective on these animals. I hope you'll join in our conversation today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Larry Miller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Gay Bradshaw, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi there.
I really appreciate you taking the time, and I certainly enjoyed your book, and there were many times when my eyebrows shot up with some of the findings and some of the things you were talking about in your book. But I'm wondering, you mentioned in your intro that you established this field of trans-species psychology. And before we go any further, maybe you can explain what that is and how it came to be.
Sure, that's great. Yeah, trans-species psychology really is nothing more than an open recognition of the entire corpus of scientific theory and data that's been accumulating even before Charles Darwin. So basically, all of science really runs on the premise and the understanding that all animals, including humans, have the same brains, mind, and capacities of thinking, feeling, and consciousness. So humans and other animals have basically the same cogs and wheels that govern all the fundamental processes that we covet. Again, cognition, emotions, consciousness, dreaming, aspirations, etc. So that has been really tacit in science, but it really has not been openly admitted. So trans-species psychology really is a way to bring attention to the fact that models of the brain, the model of the brain and the mind and consciousness, trans cuts, applies across species.
And why do you think humans historically have vilified, particularly some carnivores, especially the ones, many of the ones you talk about in your book?
Well, in general, I'll just take one little step back, is that over the last, X hundred thousands of years in the Western culture, we'll call it the sort of the Anglo-Western and now modern viewpoint, there were humans and then a very, very like Grand Canyon divide between us and other animals. And essentially predators that were called predators, carnivores, wolves, bears, sharks, crocodiles, all of those who the carnivores are defined in a strict way in terms of they eat other animals to survive, have been special because I think at a fundamental level, I go through the book in like six or seven different reasons. But one of the more, I think one of the more cogent explanations is they really intimidate our species for some reason. In other words, they really challenge our authority. They haven't been traditionally, and again, this is looking at it from the most of the book really focuses on North American species. The Europeans basically saw the carnivores as a challenge. They weren't particularly useful in any way, like a deer or an elk. They couldn't be eaten, although bears have been eaten and others, but generally speaking, they haven't been. They were used for fur, but that hasn't been really one of the main reasons. So there really is more of a psychological, I think, motivation for why we vilify these individuals, because they're challenging. They challenge our authority as being, quote unquote, the top dog, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, and let's talk. You talk about in your book, you take great white sharks. You talk about grizzly bears. You talk about orcas. Crocodiles and rattlesnakes, I think I'm missing one. Puma, I think, is the other one that you mm-hmm. talked about.
And sperm whale.
Mm-hmm. And sperm whale, yeah, absolutely. Let's take the great white, for example. And, I played a little music from the Jaws movie just to get things started here. And you can't, I don't know, have you watched that movie?
Oh, ages ago.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater.
Yeah,
that tells you a little bit about my age.
impression.
it was really, really scary. And the impression you get is that this is an animal that only wants to kill, and it will kill you if you happen to swim into it or run into it. That's basically what I think.
Right.
But the research and experiences of others that you write about cast a different view of that animal.
Yes, extremely so. And this is one of the sort of the salient features and a theme throughout the book, is that the impression, the stereotype that people have about these species is really completely far from the real quote-unquote truth, the scientific data and experience. And so, for example, for the great white shark, there's an organization called the Shark Research Institute and the Global Shark Attack File, and they've done lots of research historically, and they came up with statistics showing that there's only been over 3,000 years. I think the number is barely 1,000. I mean, it's infinitesimal. And yet those statistics are greatly exaggerated in terms of the number of shark attacks. So when you really look at great whites and other sharks, as well as the other carnivore species, you see that their attacks and eating people is negligible relative to the kind of violence that we promulgate in terms of the mass genocides, the mass violence within our country, outside, et cetera, interpersonally, and so on. So really the statistics don't seem to penetrate, and people, they tend to get ignored. And, of course, that is exaggerated in the press and, oh, my gosh, there's a big shark. So, again, this comes back to that reason is why is it that one shark, might bite someone? And they typically don't eat them, like in Jaws, with the great white sharks. This was a revelation for me. They basically, most of the people who are bitten from sharks, die from exsanguination. In other words, they bleed to death. It's kind of a bite, and as the people who are experts and have worked a lot with sharks show, I mean, they're amazing. I mean, they are incredibly powerful. They're very efficient. In fact, all of the carnivore species have to be efficient. And they're very parsimonious in terms of when they quote-unquote attack or when they, go after another animal. Because if you get wounded in any kind of way in the wild, well, that's pretty much candles. I mean, they don't have ERs, they don't have refrigerators, they don't have a thermostat that they can go back and, lick their wounds and get better. So there's a huge exaggeration between myth and actual fact.
And you talk about a couple of guys, one guy who wanted to swim and see a great white shark. I think that was a story that I found kind of interesting, where in the water, and suddenly a 15-footer appeared right mm-hmm. in front of them. Talk about that a little bit, because I think...
Yeah, his name is Frederick Bouy. He's an amazing photographer. He's Belgian, lives in the Azores, does incredible photography. He works with researchers and then is a photographer. And he just, ever since he was very young, he was fascinated with the ocean and animals in the ocean. And he became a competitive free diver, which is they hold their breath and dive down very deep. And so he doesn't wear, you know, scuba gear or anything like that. He doesn't use an air tank. He just uses a single breath when he goes down and he photographs whales and sharks. And the story that you're talking about happened when he was, I think in his early teens, and he was in somewhere in the Pacific, and he was, you know, swimming, and he encountered this shark, and as he talked about it, in fact, you know, this is many years later, he sort of reflects on it, and he says, wow, that was really an incredible experience. This shark was so curious and shy and respectful. And he said he was unusual, too. And again, this is a sort of from the vantage of time. You look back because the shark didn't have cuts and scars on him, which many white sharks have because they tussle with each other. And he was talking about how unique he was, how special he was. And that really underscored his appreciation later for not only the cultural differences in terms of these kinds of cultural personalities. You know, we talk about Italian personality and, you know, Spanish personality and Navajo personality, things like that, you know, which are obviously generalizations, but there's kind of a theme. And then there's also the individual variations. And so that was his point, as well as other people, is that it really comes down to individual personality, individual traits. So a white shark, in general, there are, and we, you know, he did these personality tests, that's in the book, you know, the big five personality, which people have used for animals to kind of talk about, are they an extrovert, are they conscientious, things like that. And you find that there are these broad, you know, categorizations, again, like the cultures, but there are these individual distinctions. And that was something that was very fascinating, because in his work, as well as other people who work with these animals that are quote-unquote so dangerous, which they really aren't, and they are dangerous in the sense of if they want to do some harm, they do. I mean, it can hurt you. But the point is they very, very rarely do. But the point is these individuals are really up close and personal. I mean, he's swimming, you know, within feet, you know, just a, you know, a snout distance. And it's because of his acumen and his attention and his appreciation of tuning in with that individual and vice versa, that the outcome is very harmonious.
Yeah. It was a fascinating story that you tell in there, Gay. Gay Bradshaw is the author of Carnivore Minds, Who These Fearsome Animals Really Are. And we're going to find out some more about sharks, perhaps, and the other animals she talks about in her book. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking with the author of the book Carnivore Minds, Who These Fearsome Animals Really Are. And she is Gay Bradshaw. She holds doctor's degrees in ecology and psychology and a master's in geophysics. She established the field of trans-species psychology when she discovered PTSD in wild elephants, wrote the book Elephants on the Edge, What Animals Teach Us About Humanity. And her latest book is called Carnivore Minds, Who These Fearsome Animals Really Are. You may have questions or comments as we talk with her about bears and sharks and other carnivores. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show a Facebook page. And, Gay, we have Tom from Brookfield with a comment. Let's go there. Tom, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi, I'm still here. Hey, you know, it's interesting that, you know, the carnivore mind, and you realize that we've created the environment that within which all of these what we would say are man-eating beasts are and dwell. And when you think back to the grizzly that ate the tourists in the mountain there, and I'm trying to think of the path to the sun back when the grizzly had stepped on the glass and became a man eater. And having been a surfer in the 60s and the 70s, I left Bolinas in 1979 after an incident where, during a storm, some children were playing near a breakwater and jetty, and a great white washed up on the jetty and took a young girl and went out to sea with it. And I encountered the father the next morning, who was grief-stricken, walking along the
shoreline, probably
the low tide line, looking for any remains of his daughter, and he was chewing me out, and I didn't have a clue as to what it was all about or why I was the target of all of his frustration and profanity and grief, until a friend of his who was walking about four paces behind explained to me that it was his daughter that was taken by the shark. And that's where I had learned how to surf, and I had had an encounter many, many years earlier, because I'd been surfing for 5 years after war in Vietnam, and up and down the California coast. And the only other experience that I'd had with a shark was when a shark had taken a sea lion, and it was his food. And there was a young boy that surfed in, and here I am trying to explain to the mother that not to be too panicked, that the boy will make it in okay, that the shark found the food that he was after, and when he came in, he was quite shaken, just like the father was. But in the end, you know, it's the natural order of things, and I'm of the opinion, and I stopped surfing, and I moved back here to Wisconsin after the fact that I had realized that things were so far out of kilter in the coast, and that was 1979.
Well, I'm going to break in because I want Gay to comment on this. Gay, any comments?
Thank you for your story. I'll just give you my impression. Is that, again, this was an example. Of course, it's grievous for anyone to lose a loved one, no matter how. But once again, you know, usually this is followed, as you describe this man, with his wrath, you know, whether it was directed at you, but obviously, you know, now we, you know, for example, like you mentioned about a grizzly, you know, if a carnivore grizzly, a shark, whoever it is, does injure or is thought to injure, even if a puma comes into a neighborhood, there's a reprisal, immediately kill by humans. And the fact of the matter is that, again, this is just really out of proportion relative to the kinds of things to worry about. Like I kind of jokingly say, you know, if we really were concerned about, you know, human fatalities, we would put a warrant out on bathtubs. I mean, for example, just like that mundane thing, huge numbers, thousands and thousands and millions of people are injured or killed within their home from some sort of accident, or look in war, or, you know, domestic violence, or, you know, cars. So the thing is the question is not that we don't also sympathize with the terrible grief, but the point is that it's way out of proportion relative to the cause, which would, in this case would be the sharks. And then you did bring up a component here. You know, Larry, you had mentioned my book on elephant PTSD. Well, elephants in Africa, if I can just take a few seconds
sure.
here, elephants in Africa are wild. And this was in the 90s, and they had, over a 10-year period, the rangers found over 100 white and black rhinoceroses who were endangered. And they couldn't figure out what it was. They thought it was poachers. No, it's not poachers. Well, it turned out it were elephants. They were young male elephants, and that's the topic of my elephant book. And so when you looked at the biographies of those elephants, they had been babies when they had been, their families had been gunned down. They were prematurely weaned. They lost their family. They were translocated. They witnessed this incredible shock, being shot down with the helicopters at the time for culling elephants. Then they were moved to a park. They did not have any family, which they normally have, in a second phase of socialization with males. So these young males were going into premature moth, which is a hormonal cycle, which is usually coincident with sexual maturity. And they were going after these rhinos. And they sexually assaulted some of them and killed them. as extraordinary. That never happens. And that was the diagnosis when, again, when you look through the lens of the neuropsychology, which is very conservative, very conventional, elephants have those capacities to have psychological trauma. And so it was a very, very conservative analysis and diagnosis. Well, the same thing does now apply for other animals. If you look at carnivores, including the sharks, including grizzlies, including wolves, they're annually killed, hundreds and hundreds and thousands, like coyotes, you know, thousands, like in one state, 40,000 a year, pumas and deer. So when you see from that perspective, then they are, this is, Tom, I think your name was, your comment about things out of order. The carnivores now are not the carnivores of today. I mean, yesterday, they have, again, it would be very conservative, very extraordinary to think that they did not suffer some trauma, that they don't have post-traumatic stress. And so they are out of balance. So we're really at the point right now where we need to get our facts straight, pull back from our own violence, you know, don't point our wrath and our fear at the animal world, be respectful, and give them time to recover. Stop hunting, you know, ban hunting, so that these populations have a chance to live a life the way they used to before in this country it was colonized. And that's ecologically consistent. In the sense of by getting rid of all the carnivores, it's created all sorts of chaos in terms of disturbing the ecosystem.
And you mentioned grizzly bears in as you were talking there, Gay. And actually, you talk about how humans and grizzly bears can get along and do get along very well under the right conditions.
Yeah, there's a gentleman, Charlie Russell, who lives in Canada. He has been working with grizzlies, you know, living with them intimately for over 70 years. He's in his 70s. And I really encourage anyone, there's a BBC film that you can see online called, I think it's Edge of Eden, which talks about his 10 years that he stayed in Kamchatka, to really look at, you know, can we live in a cogent way. It doesn't mean just like walking up and hugging a bear. It means being, you know, respectful, paying attention. Again, that's really important. You know, we're very exploitive. So it's like if we want to see a bear, we want to see a bison, we go up and see it. We take a picture or whatever. Well, that's not the way he functions, nor were the Native or American Indian people. They're very respectful. They understand. They know etiquette. It's like our neighborhood. You know, he even talks about it. It's like when you have a neighborhood, right, you don't just go blasting into someone's door. You know, you get to know them gradually. You know, you're very respectful, et cetera. And so he spent 10 years in Kamchatka for that very reason, because that area had not been exposed to the kind of relentless hunting that North American grizzlies have. In fact, the grizzlies now in North America live in 2% of their original habitat before European colonization. So in his 10 years there, subsequent, there has been a lot more poaching and violence. But he found that, yes, indeed, you know, if you're mindful, you watch your etiquette, you know, respectful, et cetera, you can develop very profound relationships, in other words, very harmonious, which is actually quite natural.
Mm. Tom, thanks again. Jim in Denmark has something for us. Jim, hello to you.
Hello. When I was a college student at UW-Madison, I hitchhiked up to the Sylvania wilderness in the UP, and I hiked in on my crutches to a West Bear Lake. And after a long hike, I was exhausted, and I arrived at bear campsite, and I threw my clothes onto the picnic table and jumped in. After a good swim, I walked back up, and the only thing left on the picnic table was my pants. Being a college student, I had a very small knapsack, and it was full of marshmallows and some caramels, because they cost less than $5. Well, I heard this grunt behind me, and following me up the trail was a humongous black bear. And he was sort of ambling and a little shy, and he walked to my right to a little pine at the edge of the site. And he bent down and picked up my knapsack, and he, as if to say, Jim, I went through this. And you were swimming. I was working.
That's a great story, isn't it?
Yeah, that's terrific.
Thank you so much for that story. And he didn't obviously didn't eat Jim. That's
right.
You know what? One of the things that fascinated me about your book was, and I'm thinking now, crocodiles, alligators, and rattlesnakes. I don't normally think about them as having emotion and diligence. You talk about the experience of someone who was, and I might have been an alligator, not a crocodile, but who came upon an animal along the edge of the water on the bank edge that had been killed by a puma, maybe, and it sat there and considered. It seemed to be considering whether or not to go and take a bite out of that dead animal. Talk about that experience.
Oh yeah, that's it was actually narrative. That story is the Morillette's or Morillet's crocodile in Belize, and it was it was a biologist who actually observed this, and it was written up in a formal scientific journal. And he had been kayaking, and they were studying crocodiles. And so he observed, and he kind of went off so he could watch, was this Morillette crocodile, you know, kind of submarine-like, you know, a little periscope-up eyes, looking at this carcass of a tapir, I believe it was, that had been killed, he thought, by a jaguar. And so he watched the crocodile wait, you know. I mean, the tapir was dead. There was no jaguar around, although I think he did hear the sound, so he knew that had been a jaguar kill. And he watched the Morillette's crocodile just wait there. And again, this is just sort of a side note here, is a number of carnivores are also scavengers. You know, it's sort of like Jim's story. You know, they run on a big engine, and they have to eat.
Yeah.
And so they're very opportunistic, so they do scavenge as well. So anyways, I was fascinated with that, and he talked about how it was very studied, you know, the crocodile, was there. And so what I did is I said, again, taking the neuropsychological lens in science, because they have brains like us, took the concept that was developed by psychologist Daniel Goldman of emotional intelligence. You know, we've all probably heard that term. In other words, where, you know, it's not just intellectual intelligence that we need to have, but emotional, how to regulate our emotions, how to be empathetic, you know, how to be self-aware. These are all these characteristics of emotional intelligence. So I look through that lens, which we can do. Again, trans-species psychology, this common model of brain and mind across species, allows us then to look at the natural history, to look at the quote-unquote behavior of an individual such as this crocodile through this lens and kind of see, you know, try to kind of see their world from the inside out, right? So that's what I did. And so I found that really, and again, although this was specific to this one crocodile, it really goes across the board for all, you know, all of the carnivores, the great whites, and anyone that is having to hunt. I showed that, you know, I kind of looked through that lens and said, well, you know, that crocodile really showed a lot of self-awareness. In other words, the crocodile has to be self-aware of how good they are. Do they have the physical capacity? Are they, you know, do they have the mental, emotional capacities to be able to make an attack or to do something, in this case was going after this tapir? Because, you know, you don't want to mess up and get an injury. So that is a feature of emotional intelligence. The other one is, you know, being able to self-regulate. You know, and again, this also goes contrary to the myth that, you know, that these animals are like these bloodthirsty kind of instincts that are just ready to grab and have no, you know, any kind of higher order faculties or whatever. Well, you know, he showed a lot of restraint. He probably was really hungry. You know, this is a great opportunity, but he didn't just go right out there, right? He waited and watched. And then empathy. Now, most of the time, you know, we think of empathy of like, you know, having soft and warm feelings for someone else, you know. I mean, having a concern, we pick up, we understand that someone might be unhappy or something. But we can look at the definition of empathy in a broader way, where we're looking at it as knowing how someone else feels, whether it's quote-unquote good or bad, or whether it's anger or whatever. So, again, the Morillette's crocodile has emotion, you know, empathetic capacity was demonstrated in the sense of a hunter has to understand, quote unquote, their prey. They have to be able to say, well, you know, and balance that with their own capacity. So what is that, you know, what is that particular, well, jaguar, you know, he has to kind of know, is that jaguar going to come back? So in other words, when you look through that perspective of the neuropsychology, you get a much more, as you called it, a very complex sort of, you know, picture of that internal landscape of who that individual really is.
Yeah, it really... And I'm going to switch to rattlesnakes for a minute because I thought, just to kind of go along with what you've been saying, there's a great story in the book about a guy who was quite familiar with a particular female rattlesnake, and it had had young, and he went looking for it one evening.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably remember that story, but tell us, that rattlesnake was very interested in protecting its young.
Yeah, you know, just a little thing here, because we're talking about crocodiles, alligators, and now rattlesnakes, which, who are reptiles, right?
Yeah.
So we have this term, you know, the reptilian brain, you know, this very primitive jaw-like, you know, jaws-like type of thing. Well, that's... there isn't a reptilian brain. In other words, that's a misnomer. It's a kind of a passé idea that the rattlesnake and the crocodile and the tortoise or turtle brain is comparable to our own. In other words, we have as much of a reptilian brain as they do. Do you see what I mean? In fact, we probably act like that, what we're supposed to. So anyways, this is a rattlesnake researcher. And the female rattler, he went out at night and, you know, he had to kind of wiggle his way, and he found it. And she put herself, like he called, I think, kind of like a coiled frisbee. She put herself, she was coiled between a cactus and something else, so he couldn't just wiggle through. And she was very much adamantly just sitting there. And so he actually was trying to, he's kind of monitoring her young, you know, the rattlesnake populations and things like that. So he kind of lifted her up and moved her. Well, then he went over there, and he was looking to see for some sort of telltale sign of the skins, because a baby rattlesnake will molt, and then they kind of go off, and they're sort of not adults, but they've come out of the nest. And so, you know, he didn't see anything, and he turned around, and there she was, and she had followed him. And so he thought that was very odd. Anyways, he went back, I think, a couple days, or I'm not sure, a period of time later with a colleague. And then he did come back, and he saw the skin. So what he realized by putting two and two together was the babies were still in the nest, and they had not molted yet. He found the molting later. And so essentially what she was doing was just keeping an eye on him. She wasn't, quote-unquote, you know, aggressive. She trusted him. She knew him. I mean, you can say this again. We can make these kinds of inferences just like we might with another human. It's consistent. In other words, the capacities that a rattlesnake mother has for emotion, for guarding her young, for having a relationship and being able, again, this is this emotional intelligence and intellectual intelligence, knowing who this human was, that she didn't necessarily have to, you know, worry about him, wanted to keep an eye on him. Making those inferences is really not crazy. It's very consistent with conventional science, and that's a perfect illustration.
Yeah, I think it is. In our last, oh boy, our last 30 seconds or so, could you oh boy, it goes so fast. Tell us about your center.
It's the Carullo Center, by the way.
I mispronounced it, sorry.
We've been around for, it's a Greek word, no one pronounces it correctly, but it is Carullo's. And we've been around for about 9 years. We have two sanctuaries. One is the Tortoise and the Hare here in Oregon, where we take in special needs, endangered desert tortoises and domestic rabbits. And we have a second sanctuary that we're going to be establishing in the southeast United States for elephant trauma recovery. So really, we look at we have a third kind of prong, which is education. We offer internships and things like that. And our focus is animal psychology, and particularly with an attention to psychological trauma recovery.
Well, you have a fascinating book and with some fascinating stories, Gay. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It was fun.
Oh, man. Gay Bradshaw is the author of Carnivore Minds, who these fearsome animals really are, and we just only scratched the surface of her book. So take a look at it. I think you'll find it very interesting. Tomorrow, our consumer protection experts come back to talk about a major Medicare change that will help protect you from identity theft. Stay with us. Lots in store.